Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Welcome to our first episode of Season 2. Our original plan was to release a two-part interview with Brinton Smith and Chris French, but after recording that interview, we wrapped up our cello auditions at the Atlanta Symphony, which unfortunately resulted in a no-hire. Following that result, Brinton and I had many conversations about his particular feelings on auditions ending without hiring anyone, which resulted in a larger conversation about all of the audition processes that orchestras implement and what works and doesn't work. So we thought we should record another interview talking about this very important topic. Brinton even opened up this conversation to the International Cello Society Facebook page, so thank you to all of you who participated with very thoughtful insights, questions, and thoughts on audition process. This helped to inform us on what we should talk about today. As for that other interview, we'll put that on the back burner for now, and we may release some of that conversation on a later date. Brinton has been principal cellist of the Houston Symphony since 2005, and is also on faculty at the Shepherd School of Music at Rice University. His teaching is highly sought after as his students have been very successful at navigating the trials and tribulations of orchestra auditions. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Happy to be here.
Brinton, why don't you start by talking about the audition process and your feelings about no hire results?
All right, let me say this first. When you're auditioning, you tend to think it's a conspiracy. You know, there's always, it's very easy to think like, oh, they just want to keep hiring subs because they don't want to have to pay health insurance. Or, you know, we've all heard these kind of theories about why orchestras have no hires. In 98% or 99% of those cases, that's not what's going on. It is a case where a committee has very sincerely tried to come to a conclusion and they just can't. At the same time, we have to acknowledge that that is a failed procedure. Now, I don't necessarily believe that a hiring should be required, though the Met's been pretty successful with that. I believe the Met has in their contract that they have to hire someone from the audition. And even I know cases where even for a principal position, if the first person they offered it to didn't take it, they're like, okay, we don't rerun the audition. We just move to the second person. And do that. Certainly, it's hard to argue that they're not a great orchestra, that they've suffered in any way for this. I would be a little bit uncomfortable as a member of a committee having a gun saying you have to hire someone. Mm-hmm. But I also know that we have this happen a lot in our industry. A lot of times we have auditions and there's no hire and then they run the audition again, and they hire some of the same people who were there at the audition last time. And yeah, I mean, in some cases, it might be that the person played better the second time, but it happens so often, and it can't always be that the person, nobody got that much better in 6 months or a year. So the question is, what happens in this process? How do we get to a place where a process kind of fails, both for the committee, for the orchestra, and for the candidates who are there? You know, you have 90, 100 people who spent probably at least $800 a piece to get to the audition, to all the time they put into preparing it. You have all the hours the committee dedicated to it, all the resources that the orchestra dedicates to getting an audition. You know, there's a lot of costs involved for the orchestra too. So, and then the process doesn't result in a hire. And I mean, for example, you know, in this case, Atlanta was, you guys were one of the very first out of the gate with one of the first big auditions coming out of COVID. Mm-hmm. But now there's going to be 7, 8, 9, 10 auditions that are going to happen before you guys can audition again. And a lot of the potential pool gets eaten up by other orchestras. So, you know, it's going to be a more challenging situation when you run it again. nobody wants to end up in that situation, but I think we need to look in our industry about how we end up in this situation. I'll give you a little bit of anecdotal from my own life. So there was a period when I was principal of the Fort Worth Symphony, and I was mostly taking title auditions. I'd been having good, not complete success, but I'd been getting to the finals of a lot of orchestra principal auditions, including one of the top seven principal auditions that I got to the finals of twice, and they decided to do a kind of invitation rounds instead after they had the open auditions.
Yeah.
And I realized that I was probably needed something else on my resume besides Fort Worth Symphony, because I needed some professional experience. I thought it's, you know, it would be really probably good for my career to really try and play in a big orchestra, see how life is in a big orchestra. And of course, Fort Worth is a much bigger orchestra now than it was then. But I thought that would be good experience for where I ultimately wanted to go. And I had been in the finals for associate principal of New York Phil. And I talked with Carter after that, and he said, you know, I'd love to have you in the section here. Why don't you come audition for the section of New York Phil? So they had a section audition coming up the year after that. I tried to do everything right. I played for a bunch of people in the section. I played for Carter. I played, tried to make sure I knew their style and I knew exactly what was going on. I prepared. Mm-hmm. Went in and played. And after just having been in the finals for the associate, I got cut in the first round of the section of New York Phil. And they had ultimately a no hire audition for that. A year later, it came and posted again. And this time I was like, whatever, I don't care. I mean, I was just, I'll show up and take it if it's convenient. I didn't play for anyone. I didn't do anything. And that was the one I ultimately ended up winning. So I always thought in my head, okay, well, I must have played better the second time. And the first one, I did something kind of very not legal, but I recorded myself in the first audition. And I never listened to it because I was like, well, I didn't advance. What's the point? I listened to it like 5 years later. I was like, actually, that was pretty good.
Huh.
That was probably maybe better than I played the second time. I don't know why I didn't pass that first time. Certainly, there have been plenty of auditions where I know exactly why I didn't pass because I did something. Or to give you another example, when I was leaving the New York Phil, there was an audition, and maybe just to keep this anonymous, we won't talk about what section it was, but there was an audition where there was one position and only one person made it to the finals.
Uh-huh.
And Lauren Mazel heard the person and said, this person is not an interesting musician. I would never hire this person for anything.
Huh.
Then they ended up having two vacancies the next year. The audition ran again. They had five finalists. This girl was one of the five finalists, and Mazel's like, oh, she's wonderful. Yes, hire her. She didn't change that much. She's not that different of a player. She was wonderful the first time. She was wonderful the second time. I think there's a psychological aspect of this, and there's committee psychology. There's issues like that. I think we need to be honest about and aware of and think about and understand that this is people making a decision. And a lot of times when we fail in this process, it's because we don't quite have a clear idea, a unified idea of what we're looking for.
Well, let's talk about that and explore that a little bit more then. When you say that, can you expand a little bit more on what you mean by a unified idea of what we're looking for?
Well, so there's a couple of different, and this is some of what we were talking a little bit about on Facebook on that thread. I mean, there's different ways of hiring, right? Different orchestras do different things. For instance, the Berlin Phil, I think the repertoire for the last cello audition was Haydn D major and a Romantic Concerto, Dvorak or Schumann, and the slow movement of the Arpeggione Sonata. Mm-hmm. And they take the person they think is the best player, they put them in the orchestra for a year. And I think they have large committees, too. You know, I think anyone who wants to come to the audition from the orchestra can come and vote.
Well, it's actually, I can tell you, because I talked to Noah about this, the concertmaster. And in the first round, it's the section that they're auditioning for. The second round is opened up to the entire orchestra on stage in front of the entire orchestra with no screen. So it
amazing.
Is pretty different. But yeah. Keep going. So you're talking about what they listen to.
And then
to.
They, yeah. And then so they're basically, you know, you can tell from the repertoire, okay, they're not looking for does this person Russian, Mendelssohn, Scherzo? They are like, okay, who's the best solo player, basically? And then they throw them in the orchestra, and they are, I think, pretty, I mean, more rough with their tenure process than the U.S. orchestras are.
Yeah.
They are more likely to kick you out after a year if you don't fit in. But the audition is just geared only towards kind of finding the best player. The English system is probably maybe the complete opposite.
Okay.
In the sense that it really is like an interview for a job. This is, you know, kind of the dichotomy of what is an audition? Is it a competition? Is it to find the best cellist and then go from there? Or is it like a job interview where you're looking for cultural fit? You're looking for personality. You're looking for all these experience. Are you, you know, and the English process is almost kind of more like an interview process where you'll play for several months with the orchestra often, and several people will play for several months, and then they'll choose from those people, okay, who are we comfortable with? Who do we like? Who's the best fit for our organization? It's not going to be based necessarily on who plays the best Dvorak concerto. And it's funny, you know, you see this on committees where some people are like, you know, wow, this person's an amazing player. I'd be inspired to have them in my section. And other people are like, they don't even want to hear the concerto in the audition round because they're like, this isn't a concerto playing job. What's the point of listening to how they play concertos? Let's hear the excerpts. I think they're both kind of legitimate ideas, but they're different ways of going about the hiring. And I think we have a little bit of a strange hybrid system in America where we're kind of looking for like who plays the best orchestral excerpts as a soloist.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how useful it really is. I mean, eventually it can be learned and it can be done, but how much does it tell us about how they're going to actually function in the orchestra?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because my training was play the excerpts at the highest level possible, play them with a knowledge of the repertoire, play them like you're sitting in the orchestra, play them like they make sense, and make sure your solo is solid and really good because that's the first thing that people hear. And personally, I can only speak from my own perspective, but I weigh the excerpts more heavily than the concerto. I want to hear somebody play their solo really well to see what kind of player they are. But I want to hear somebody that sounds like they really understand the repertoire. And I do think that when you hear a player that sounds like they understand the repertoire, that does give you some inclination as to whether they have an understanding of what's going to happen when they sit in the section. It doesn't help you with everything, but it gives you at least some measure. But you are correct. I mean, this is a competition setting for an orchestra job. So
right.
I don't know how we got here, but that's where we are now.
And part of the problem is there are so many good people and you have to find a way to eliminate them. You're looking for a way instead of, you know, a hiring process is kind of, you would think that you have just a few people and you're looking from those few people for the best fit. You do like kind of a more intensive screening. A competition is kind of like, okay, you take all comers and then who's the best player from that? And in some ways, they're almost at cross purposes, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that is something that's a huge problem. The way that we're looking to listen to somebody has nothing to do in the end with what's expected of them at the job. But how do we get to a place where we can do both at the same time?
But there's also a philosophical question of what do you want? And that's a question that the committee and the section and the orchestra has to answer. What are you looking for? Are you looking for, and just to give an example of two great sections that do things a little bit differently. Now, Berlin has the academy, so in a way they do hire a lot from the academy, but Berlin is probably the most open European orchestra to international people coming in and auditioning, and just you can just show up there and play. I don't know if it's still that way. It was that way when we were younger, and I never did it, but I always, you know, Berlin was one of the few German orchestras that would actually hear people coming from different countries, from different traditions, very international orchestra. Vienna, I think, is probably almost the exact opposite. You know, they're very proud of the fact that they train and they have a whole system and they train you to play in the Vienna Phil way. And they have things that are just kind of understood that are culture of the orchestra for 100 years. They don't want people. Well, of course, they've had other issues with not being open to other things like gender and things like that. But they are not looking for people. They're looking for people within their own culture and their own system. So they're both great sections. They're both great orchestras. They have a different philosophy in hiring. And I think there's U.S. orchestras have different philosophies in hiring. I mean, for me, when I'm hiring in Houston, it's very important to me that I find someone who's, to me, a very interesting musician and player. And I'm not necessarily looking for people who are all the same as the last person we hired. You know, I'm looking for maybe someone, okay, this person is this kind of, then maybe we want someone who's here. I'm looking for kind of a little bit of a balance. Other orchestras are kind of looking for, okay, this person is a very good fit. This is kind of, you know, very smooth. This works in that, you know, this will be the same as this person, this will be the same as this person. And I don't know that one of these is right or wrong, but I do know that when committees get in trouble, often it's because people are eliminating each other's picks, if you know what I mean. Like the people who are looking for the great orchestral fit are eliminating people who are maybe great soloists, but a little more clueless on the excerpts. And the people who are, you know, looking for the kind of the competition mentality, the best player mentality, or maybe eliminating some of the people whose concerto was maybe not quite as strong, but who really shows some sensitivity in the excerpts. And it's easy to say, well, we want someone who has everything, but there's not a player alive who has everything on every given day. You know, I mean, we're all humans. None of us has ever played a perfect audition, not anyone out there listening. I mean, it's we all have strengths and weaknesses to different degrees. So I think we have to think about how do we get more of a consensus without discussion, because usually I don't know how you do it there. We don't have discussion between rounds.
No discussion.
Yeah, it's just voting. And so how do you get from a place where you don't eliminate people who might be somebody that really should be looked at more seriously? You know, I mean, I can tell you just by knowing so many of the people who are there, I can tell you at an audition like yours or Detroit or Houston or any of these, there's almost always 10 to 15 people who are great cellists who would do a great job. And it's how do we make a process that maybe is a little, I don't know if the right word is sympathetic. I don't know that I have the answer, but a process that is a little more forgiving so that we don't have to hear these people three times in a row before we realize like, oh, this is the right fit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to first and explore when you say unification on a committee. Are you talking about unified for what you're looking for?
Exactly.
I mean, I think we're all unified when it comes to pitch, rhythm. Well, sound is more subjective, but let's say at least intonation and rhythm, I think most of us at this level certainly can agree whether we're
right.
Unified on those things.
Those things are the basics.
Right. So you're saying that the unification process that you feel can result in a no hire is by having some people on the committee that put more weight onto the solo repertoire for a player and other people who put more weight into the excerpts.
Yeah, it's a little...
And that ends up canceling each other out.
It's a little bit like if you had a process that keeps trying to pick the fastest horse, the fastest horse, the fastest horse, and then you get the fastest horse in the end and you're like, well, why doesn't this horse know how to jump hurdles or hunt foxes or something? It's like, well, okay, then you should have been picking probably for the entire process. You know, depending on what your ultimate priority is going to be, you want to make sure that your process is finding that. And of course, we also get, you know, the other time you get in the no hire auditions is often if you have a conductor who comes in the last stage of the process and say an orchestra committee has been like pitch rhythm excerpts. And so you get some people who are very reliable and very solid. And then the conductor comes in and they're like, well, no, I want someone who's, I want someone who's
more interesting,
more interesting. And why aren't these people interesting? And it's like, okay. The other thing is numbers too. I mean, we never, as people knowing this podcast might not know, passing is based on a certain number of votes, getting a certain number of votes out of the committee. In Houston, we have like 7 member committees. So it's 4 votes out of the 7. I'm not sure how many are on your committee.
It's the same.
Same
thing here.
We don't know how other people are going to vote. we used to have discussion between rounds, and we eliminated that in the idea of trying to make a fairer process so that nobody could kind of twist arms on the committee. Because if the principal comes and says, no, I really want to hear this person again, then everyone's going to feel like they have to change their vote. But what we found is that we were losing some great players at three votes. There were some players that I was like, oh my God, how could this person not have passed? Someone I thought was maybe one of the best people I'd heard all day. And they end up on the cusp with three votes. And then afterwards, you discuss afterwards, and people are like, oh, I almost voted for that person, but I was kind of on the fence because yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And
can you tell us, though, if you can talk about this, how when you are on a committee, how do you unify the committee in a way that's unifying but not taking away the fact that having seven diverse opinions is why you want a committee?
Right. Well, one thing we've done is we've put in something in our contract that if somebody gets three votes with no discussion, there's an immediate revote. So that if somebody was like leaning like, oh, I was almost going to vote for that person, and then they see they got three votes, they can change the vote. And if they don't want to, and it's anonymous, so if they don't want to, if they just want to stay with nope, no means no, they can stay with that. That's one thing we've done to try and pick up some of those leaners and try and bring them through into the next round. The other thing we try to talk a little bit about before we start, the kinds of things that we're looking for in our section. You know, a lot of it is the committees, right? We're fortunate in our orchestra, and you probably are there too, that there's a lot of good people to choose from. But, you know, getting people who both have really good critical ears, but also a certain generosity of spirit, understanding how hard it is to take an audition. You know, it's very easy when you haven't taken an audition in a long time. There's an old, one of my friends in Chicago Symphony tells me the joke there is the older I get, the better I used to be kind of thing. You know, it's very easy when we haven't done this in years to be like, and you're listening to a lot of good players play next to each other, you can get overcritical sometimes. So I try to remind people that a yes vote is not a vote to hire. A yes vote is a vote to hear someone again. Mm-hmm. Only in the very last round is the yes vote a vote to hire. But everywhere before that, it's a vote to hear someone again. And as tiring as the process is, it's always better to have more options. And, you know, if there's any doubt, hear them again. Let's see. Because I think it's so easy to make a mistake by being too critical. When you sit on the committee, I do it too. We lose some perspective on how hard it is to play these things well. And, you know, if someone has seven excerpts that are fantastic and one excerpt that's not great, hear them again.
Yeah.
You know, make the choice to spend the extra time, hear them one more time, because you often find the gems that way.
Yeah, I think the other thing that's unique about what we just went through is we've never gone through a global pandemic and had no job auditions for at least a year and a half. I think if we look at the last couple auditions that happened right out of the gate, Atlanta being one of them, it seems to me that a lot of people during the start of the pandemic with schools shutting down and finding a really hard time being motivated, myself included, in that process, it's possible that our expectation was that coming off of all this time, there'd be so many people that you would expect that there'd be a high level overall. But I think that there was sort of this funk that hung over this whole business. And as people got the opportunity to come play again, that it almost had the opposite effect. Because taking auditions is a bit of a cumulative effect, I think, for a lot of people. Those of us who were not as good at taking auditions did much better once we started to rack a few up in a row and got in a groove. And there's no question that there were enough talented people at this audition, but how do those people stand out when it feels that we might be making concessions on all of the fundamentals that we care about first? So if you're listening to a bunch of candidates play, and this is a hypothetical, but let's just say that you're listening to a bunch of people and they're either rushing or intonation's not solid enough, or maybe you personally feel that the sound is not great. Because again, I feel like sound is the most subjective of those three things. Although intonation, you know, there's definitely some subjectivity in there too.
Depends on the instrument too, yeah.
Yeah. So, but where do you make those concessions to hear those great players? Because if there is a general feeling that Well, let's back up for one other second. A lot of things are changing right now in the auditions, and I think that's why this conversation is so relevant. So, for example, the screening of resumes, a lot of orchestras have eliminated that to allow anybody to come audition, which, by the way, is something that does not happen in Berlin, just to point out some of those differences. If you allow everyone to show up, then you're really starting to squeeze the time that you can listen to people. And so while trying to do a service in listening to as many people as you can, ultimately time is always the factor. Time and exhaustion, as we know, because the committee sits for 8 or 9 hours, and also being a human being, we all have our own limitations. So that, I think, is part of the difficulty of it. But the biggest thing is, if one is sitting and listening on a committee and feels that those basic fundamentals are not being met at the level that you've come to expect in an orchestra of a high level, then how do those players that we know are good show through if many of them are not having the kind of day that we know that they can when they're not under this sort of microscopic pressure or having a year and a half of no auditions behind them?
Yeah. And you're talking on a couple of levels that are quite interesting, I think. One of them, yeah, we're talking about the fact that it's not that necessarily the people weren't motivated, that they weren't practicing, but they didn't have the experience of taking auditions for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And for many of us, it was the process of taking auditions where we kind of learned how to play in an audition, which is tangential. I mean, it's you can't play well in an audition if you're not a good player, but there's very easy to be a good player and not play well in an audition. I don't think there's anybody out there at this point, or very few, who haven't lost auditions at this point. And it is part of the process. It is part of the learning process. So there are certain personalities and certain types of playing that are very conducive to the audition process, that just work well. I have one student who's never not been to the finals of any audition he's taken. Just like, I can't do that. It was like, It's like, wow, okay. And he's, you know, he's taken, that's like 10, 11 auditions, including some major, major auditions. So there are certain types of players that do very well kind of intrinsically, organically in this. But I think for the rest of us, it's a learned process. And I think you're probably onto something in the sense of saying that it's people are shakier at the audition and not showing what they are as well as they could, because they haven't had the experience of taking auditions for the last couple of years. And in fact, I can just tell you, like with my class at Rice, yeah, we took last year and it was great. We worked on repertoire and we went through sonatas and showpieces and we talked a lot about music and all that kind of stuff. But then it was like this fall, it was like, oh my God, like orchestral excerpts every week again. And
yeah,
it was a complete sea change in diet. But the other problem is that we don't have enough time. We don't have enough time, to be fair. And the less time we have, the less we really see people.
Yeah.
For instance, by the time you're hearing people in the finals, if you've heard them 3 times, and for us in the finals, at least they give us track back numbers so that we can see, okay, this is the way this person played in this round. And that way you see, I like having that, because that way I can say, oh, you know what? He played the same excerpt in the first round and I had the exact same comment about it. Then I know something. Or, hey, you know what? He played in the first round and I loved his playing, or I hated his playing. It tells me something. It gives me a more complete picture, I think. But we don't have enough time in the audition process. And this is where I think the first round of the audition process has to change.
Yeah.
If we want to hear everybody, which I think is the right way to do it, we have to utilize modern technology. We're in the 21st century and we have still an audition procedure that was designed in the 1960s when there were 12, 15 people showing up for an audition. We have now over 100 people. Some of them are not nearly ready and some of them are fantastic. And if you're going to take just this microscopic slice of every candidate, we're going to make a mistake. The more time we spend with people, the less likely it is that we're going to make a mistake, and the more likely it is that they're going to show themselves at their best. And you know what it's like when you get to 15, 20 semifinalists and you're looking at what that round is going to be. And if you try to do too much at once, if you try to make too long a day, you go from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., your brain to be perfectly honest, for most of us on the committees, now maybe not all, but for most of us, I think our brains do not function as well.
Yeah.
You know, we all know the lunchtime effect where the people are heard much more generously right after the committee has lunch than right before the committee has lunch when they've heard like 5 or 6 hours. We all know the effects that happen sometimes when if you play early and the field is a little bit weaker in the morning, and then you're have a very good chance of going through. But if you play at the end of the day and they already have 19 semifinalists and they're like, oh my God, their semifinals are, we've passed so many already and this is going to take forever. We're never going to get through this. And you screw up one excerpt, then people are going to be like, well.
Well, actually, there are some good solutions to those two things, though. And one of them, I will say, there is a movement in many orchestras, and I think that this is a challenge, but to not track back the numbers so that each round is utilized as a separate event. That is much harder, I think, to also make a judgment there. But there is a movement in orchestras to do that.
So I got to ask, what's the benefit of that?
I think the one benefit I would say is that if you have any time between the prelims or the semis and any leaks come out about what numbers specific candidates are, it can mess up the anonymity process. That's one of them.
Okay, I could see that. Like if there was a big gap between finals and... Like in your case, you guys had several weeks. You guys had like a month between semis and finals. So I could kind of see it there. But like if you're doing it in a single day.
Right. And again, I don't happen to agree with that strategy because I think you're already getting such limited information. So it's already very challenging. If you're trying to make decisions in a vacuum in each round and you have, like you said, if you can go back and look, did this person rush that before? Did this person do this similar thing before, it gives you more complete information on someone as a whole person without a resume or seeing the person and having completely blind auditions. So in one of the ways to be most fair, how do we get enough information to make a judgment about somebody? And that's an area of discussion right now. The other one is, and this is something that we've implemented that I think is a great solution. If people know how many numbers pass through each round, like if you know at the end of each hour or 2 hours how many people are passed on so that you get through 7 or 8 hours and you know you have 20 semifinalists, then what's going to happen? Human nature is we can't listen to that many more. You could have 10 great players that come in the next round and you don't pick any of them because you feel like you already have enough semifinalists. So that is something that has been eliminated here that I think is very helpful is we don't have any idea until we get to the next round. Or at the end of the preliminaries, we then would find out what the total number of semifinalists is. I think that makes for a fairer process in that capacity to eliminate that.
That makes sense. I worry on the flip side of that, what happens if you don't get enough? For example, if you have two positions, and of course, none of you knew going in how many finalists you're going to have because you're just voting for that. I think your way is actually the best. It's just... I think it's good for people to be generous in their voting always. And people might be scared to be generous in their voting if they think like, oh, we're going to have 22 finalists or something. But I think the solution is to have enough time in the semis.
Brinton and I had so much to talk about on this topic that we divided this episode into two parts. Part two will be available in 1 week on January 14th. So be sure and catch that as we continue this conversation with a deep dive into the topic of trial weeks and explore Brinton's innovative ideas on how to find a more efficient method of listening to so many candidates in the preliminary rounds. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. We're here to serve you. So if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.